remember saying to myself, what am I doing here? What the hell am I doing here? I kind of feel a little bit like that tonight, you know? What am I doing here? If someone had said a couple years ago, I'd be over here talking to Roxy Gadets, and my wife would be here, and my son John would be here, I'd told them they're crazy. But as the time-worn phrase goes, it's a pleasure to be here. And so Colonel Coney and wife, and my wife Elaine, and officers, ladies and gentlemen of the Cadet Corps. Tonight I'd like to just talk about how it was in the Air Force, starting out with the U.S. Army Air Force. Talk about World War II, Korea, Vietnam era, and my career as a fighter pilot. Now, if I were to add, say, World War I information, this would give you your total roots, where we were coming from, what your roots are. I think it's important to know your roots. We see it so much today. It's important to know your history. I'm going to talk again, as seen to my eyes, it's just sort of a laid-back story of my life, one fighter pilot. I was not the best, but I was one of them. When you consider that less than 1% of the military pilots made ace, and yet we accounted for over 40% of the kills. Now, I'm going to emphasize the full career aspect. I've been shot up, shot down, spun, crashed, burned, prisoner of war. They were the good times. It was a hell of a deal. It was a full career. I did everything I wanted to do and the Air Force wanted me to do. I'm going to hit on the humor side because you get a lot of that E equals MC squared and stuff in college and ROTC. But I think humor is important. I have defused many a situation in the air especially and in combat and in prison camp with just a tad of humor. You know, that business like we're lost but we're making good time. That sort of stuff. I mean, you gotta have fun. You don't have fun when you sleep, or when you eat, or when you go to school, when are you gonna have it? It's not just the Spruce and the Rothschild over there in Moscow. Remember now, in between all this humor and the stories, there's years of hard duty, but good duty. Again, I'm gonna focus on fighter pilot. I will agree with the importance of every other position in the Air Force, whether you're a bomber pilot, navigator, crew chief, whether you're a weapons system officer, whether you're a personnel officer, or whatever. It's a team approach. And without a team approach, I would never have gotten 1 hour of flying time, I never would have dropped a bomb, I never would have got a victory. I've got copious notes here. I got 30 years to cover in 60 minutes. It's an impossible task, but I'll do it. I want to stress, you know, that I went from P-40s, 200 knots, to Mach 2 and F-111 in 30 years. You guys are going to start in Mach 2 fighters and go to space. It's being done today. Now, it's important to note, I think, that all Air Force jobs, whether as leader, manager, support, or what, are designed to put a weapon system in the air, whether it's manned or unmanned. A long time ago, we come up with kind of a harsh saying, and that is, the mission of the Air Force is to fly and fight, and don't you forget it. I also believe, myself, that the Air Force ought to get back a little more to combat leaders and less of the managerial type stuff. We need the managers, but I think if you're going to lead in combat, then be a bloody leader. I'd like to say now what I think it takes to become an officer. It hasn't changed much as far as basics. First off, maybe strange enough to you people, it's attitude. You've got to have a positive attitude or you're not going to make it. There's no question about it. Leadership, you gotta want it. You gotta want to be a leader and work towards it. You gotta have guts. Gotta be aggressive. Tom Wolfe in his book, The Right Stuff, he kept up on the idea. Gotta be able to communicate. And as I've told my whole family of 8 kids, you gotta improvise. And if you can improvise, you can rule the world. Then, George Washington needed these attributes of his officers. These are qualities that'll go on forever. Today, though, I think you could add lots of things. You could add enthusiasm. You gotta be a bit of an adventurer. You gotta add that spirit. Education today is becoming paramount. We have systems, as you all know, and I understand 38% of you guys are brats from the service. You're all going to college, so you're all smart to one degree or another. We have complex systems coming up. Sometimes the systems fail. You must go back to a chart. Set of dividers, maybe, you see. But we need the education. Now, waxing philosophical, war is probably the ultimate indignity that man can foist on man. It's a failure of diplomacy, morality, whatever. Then they ask you and I to fight, and the diplomats get back in the pinstripe suit and take over, and it's a dumb circle. But you gotta remember one thing. The goal, not the mission, but the goal of the armed forces is to prevent war. And the reason we have all this stuff is not to go fight with it, it's to prevent war, rather. But if you must fight, then like the Army says, be the best that you can. For my deal, it was to be a fighter pilot of the Air Force. Now, history has proven, I can see some hackles coming already, history has proven that it was the fighter pilot who took the war to the enemy. Took the war to the enemy. Look in all your history books, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the fighter pilot went in and took the war and did the bombing and strafing and knocking out the flak and so forth. Yes, and I know Bob's sitting there trying to get rebuttal, there is a lot of missions where they went into Berlin without the fighters, but we caught up, we got the tanks, we caught up. But I think that's a true statement. Let me start at the beginning. I was born and raised in Newark, New Jersey. Like Martin Luther King said not too far long ago, he said, I had a dream, and I had a dream. I started out with this dream by getting a ride in a Jenny, a World War I Jenny. And after that, it was pure fantasy land. I built model airplanes, and I read books, and I used to sail the model airplanes out of the barn, and we'd fight, and you know, we'd set them on fire, and one day I'd come back to the barn and set the barn on fire. That all went to hell. Then as World War II and claimed the world, I tried to enlist in the RCAF. They were loaded, so I joined as a private in the United States Army Air Forces in 1942 as an 18-year-old type. Got to be a cadet in 1943. The training then consisted of about 11 months, strangely enough, about the same as we were doing here. And that was, we had classification, pre-flight, we had primary flying school, basic, and advanced flying school. Pre-flight was at Maxwell, essentially was to make soldiers in those days, airmen out of civilians in a real rapid pace. We studied some basic ground school stuff for flying. Had a lot of hazing. We had to have it. For instance, we had a rat line. The rat line was the gutter. We had to walk in the gutter, and they called it a rat line because they had to walk at 140 paces a minute. They looked like a bunch of rats scurrying around. They called it the rat line. And about the time you're dead tired at night, they'd say, Mr. Bettinger, get off the rat line. You step off the rat line, and then they would haze you until you either broke or did something. You know, you'd make like a P-38 or fly like a bird and just stuff. But it worked. It worked. If you didn't like it, and you gave somebody some guff, they gave you a tour. A tour is 1 hour of walking or 1 hour cleaning urinals. And I never left the base at Maxwell. I had a real bad problem because I got sick and my former classmate, my upperclassman, and I get, you know, called him by the first name and things like that. So I always had 10 tours and 20 tours and 30 tours, and that's all I did was walk and clean urinals. The main thing we flunked guys out was for attitude. Bad attitude. Sorry to say, but especially XGIs. They figured they had corporal stripes or buck sergeant, and I don't have to take this stuff, and they couldn't take it. We washed them out. Okay, into the flying. We had PT-17s. Biplane, built by Boeing. Good airplane. I learned to fly in about 8 hours. I soloed. Solo for me was just about it. Probably like God, we had girls out there. Like a guy's first experience with a girl. We learned general things, take off, land, aerobatics, no formation, no instruments, strictly VFR. Had a lot of accidents. We were brand new. The airplane was a ground looper. A lot of cadets, not a lot. Several come in. Ground loop, upside down, they would cut the switches, figure they got it made, open the lap belt, fall out and break their neck. Got it buried, dead. Another case, the lap belts, I don't know why some guys wanted to, you know, land and get out of the airplane early, they open in the pattern. And instead of being at 500 feet, you start to creep up, you're looking around, 607, the guy said, I said 500 feet, you pop the stick and out they'd go, make a big nylon letdown. One case that actually happened. Sometimes when you solo, before you can solo, the guy's a little bit antsy, and this instructor said, well, I'll tell you what, we had removable sticks, I don't know why. The instructor pulled the pin, removed the stick, and showed the cadet, and flipped it. And the cadet, not to be outdone, pulled the pin and threw it. And a perfectly good airplane with two sets of rudder pedals and no stick, and they both bailed out. On the basic, the BT-13, the Volt-T vibrator, we call it. Bigger aircraft, prop pitch, flaps, mixture. Good training we got. Got instruments. We fly, we learned to fly the beam. And the beam was the most nothing you've ever heard about. We did some night flying. I had a real cocky instructor. He was 20 years old. He wanted to go to combat. I kind of goofed up a few times. I learned to say to myself, better to ask forgiveness than permission. Like I went out buzzing, and I got caught. The reason I was out buzzing, once I knew what I was doing, was the guys were to let us know back from combat, for God's sakes, learn to fly in the deck, you're going to bust your banana. So we would go out and buzz, and then I would get caught. And they said, are you doing that? Yeah, well, oh, don't do it anymore. It's a good deal. So I kind of used that all through my career. Better to ask forgiveness than permission. Anyhow, this guy used to bring me over the field every sortie and say, time to 10,000 feet. And he'd say, all right, spin and count them. And I go, one, two, three, four. And I pull it out the pattern and I land. Every mission. And they sent him off to combat and he got killed in his first mission. Into advanced T-6s, retractable gear, got more instant flying, more formation flying, night flying. It was a ground loop in airplane too, because I ground looped once. Didn't hurt me. Kept me on my toes. Only way to keep the troops on their toes. <Never mind. laughs> I'll just move the journals up 4 inches, but I had a chance. Had a chance to fly the P-40. They said the upper 10% of the cadets could fly the P-40. Now, I was not a hot rack, a hot rock, but I was a warm stone. I got that P-40. And you know, most fighter pilots, just by their nature, it seemed you can't just fly straight and level. After about 5 or 10 minutes, it was loops and rolls and the whole bit. And I was felt pretty good about that in 19. We had some guys took off straight ahead. They got scared to death, ran out of gas, brains and altitude, primed in the field, got out, took their wings. They quit. You know, another guy flew, forgot to bring his gear up. He's doing all these rolls and loops and down. What a lousy airplane. They had the gear down the whole show. I got one rating after all that training. I got one rating. And I think what you guys must go through, Academy guys go through, and my one-liner said, cocky and irresponsible, fighter material only. Cocky, yes. Irresponsible, no. I'm here 30 years later talking to you guys. 40 years later. Okay? So finally, my dream started to materialize, and I got to be a second lieutenant in March of 1943, and I was on my way. Naturally, with that kind of a rating, they put me in Thunderbolts at Perry Field in Florida to jug. It was probably one of the better airplanes we had in a long time. It was named after Juggernaut, not because it looked like a jug, which it did, but it was a Juggernaut, and a Juggernaut just sweeps everything in front of it. 2,000 horsepower, 16-foot prop, just terror of an airplane. There was no hazing now. Things were serious. We were going to go to war in a few months. Did a lot more formation flying, instrument flying. We picked up gunnery. Gunnery was pretty primitive. We had a fixed sight. 100 mils. We had a rag we'd fire at. It was 6 feet by 30 feet long when you're looking at it 90 degrees. When you're behind it, it's an eighth of an inch wide. Just the thickness of the material. And you'd get awful cocky and get on down there where you're getting hits and suck up the rag and shoot down the tow ship. I didn't do that. So I was off to combat. I joined my outfit, 57 fighting group. And I got in Casablanca and took 48 boxcars. That's 40 cattle and 8 men. They had just recently taken the cattle out. Went into Constantine, picked up about 10 hours of refresher course in the jug, because we'd been off about 2 months. And then I went up to Naples, and I joined them the day Vesuvius blew up, Mount Vesuvius. Mm-hmm. You talk about Mount St. Helens and that one over in Hawaii is going out. That stuff roared down the mountains, just burned the tires off the B-25 off. It was heading for our way. So we leaped off to Corsica. Part of the reason we went there, we participated in what the people in the headshed called Operation Strangle. The idea was to cut straight, this put us several hundred miles behind the line, except we're on the island of Corsica. Operation Strangle was to cut straight across Italy and knock out every target we could, every railroad, every bridge, every road, whatever we could find. Would you believe I lost my place? Yes, there it is. And on our arrival, we had nothing but a strip, a dirt strip. We were eating root shoots, nuts and berries. We lived in little tents down the strip. And the Germans came and bombed us, so we learned to get the hell out of there. And we moved back in the mountains. My first mission came along, and it was almost my demise because I forgot to drop my bombs. The old sport said, shoot on the way down to keep the gunners down, to keep the flak down. And I did, and I was shooting up a whole bunch of tank cars, and they all blew up. 2,000 or 3,000 feet of black orange smoke, and I get so enamored with that crap. I forgot the bomb. I kept screaming up between the trees, and geez, you know, first mission. Wow. I'd like to take you sort of through a typical mission. In those days, we had a squadron briefing, talked about the target. Let's say it's a marshaling yard of trains. We got general intelligence, we got a weather briefing, we got E&E briefing. We were told where the bomb line was, in other words, you could bomb above it, you couldn't bomb below it. We discussed our route in, route out. Then we had flight briefing, we discussed details, who's going to take over, alternate lead, space we're going to lead, the whole deal. We took off and got in flights of four, like so, wingtip formation. Break my arm doing this. And we steamed off to combat in that way. Then when we got near the coast of Italy, we break up what they call a box four, turn our guns on, give a squirt, make sure they work, and go on into the target. We normally picked up 20 millimeters down low, then 40 millimeters, and the big stuff, 88s up high. And they were the first time they used radar, and they could plot you pretty well. So we always sort of jinked. We skidded our airplane, skidded up 1,000 feet, went on down, and made it a lousy ride. But that's the only way to keep ahead of the radar. The bombing, for a Thunderbolt, rolling about 10, 12,000 feet, punch down about 400 knots and pull out about 6. And depending on how much flak, we would maybe stay on down to the deck after we got out of the bomb burst and mill around and shoot up anything we find. You know, people, rolling stock, trains, cars, whatever. We used to fire max distance, and the reason was a lot of those trucks would blow up in your face. If you drilled in too close, 1,200 feet or so, and when they blew, you'd catch it all in a prop in the cockpit. So we used to fire at max distance, and I'll bring that back later on. Now, the return home, we'd stream out, go back in the fingertip. Usually we'd get a DF steer if the weather was bad. In those days, you'd say, no radar, DF steer, direction finding, they would triangulate, and we had the British running it, and they were sharp. In the old days in the States, you had to give a big call from 1 to 10, 9, 8, 7, and they'd still screw it up. And those guys, I remember the call sign would say, hello, Blacktop, this is Jackpot, crest steer. Right, steer 270. They could put you right over the airdrome. Our targets on Strangle, again, were tunnel busting. Tunnel busting, I used to like that. It was kind of a sneaky trick. You would skip in with the first flight, would skip in 72-hour delays. They'd go in the middle of the tunnel. The next couple of flights would close up both ends. So those Italians would get the hiking away, getting all that rubble out. Just about the time they got the ends clear, the ones in the middle go through. And all we'd have Italians on both ends. Troop concentrations, I never did like it. You know, it's tough to commit. You roll over at 12 Thunderbolts and said, there's Germans, there's Americans. That's always a tough deal. I didn't particularly like it. I never fired on our own troops, but it's been done many times. Bridges, railroads, highway bridges, mountain roads, some of the passes in Italy. Boy, if you knocked out that mountain road, that was all. They couldn't go no place. Airfields, lots of flak. I've shot up. Some people used to counter airplanes on the ground. I've probably got about 8-10 airplanes on the ground, including those 6 engine, I can't even get the name of them. Incidentally, all the things I talk about tonight, except the 111, they're all in the museum. All the airplanes I talk about. The first couple I just talked about, all in the museum. We did some maritime stuff, ships, boats, destroyers, whatever we could find. Just like to say, that flak suppression for a fighter pilot was the worst mission they ever invented. Not that we were doing any peachy keen dropping bombs straight. But it's if you're flying air to air and I can see and it's a pretty nice deal. But all those flak guns, hundreds of them sometimes, you just don't know what to do next. Sometimes you gotta fake them out, make them fire, and then go back and fly down a gun barrel. That's something we never liked. I wanted air to air, I wanted to make A's, and it was tough going. I got pretty proficient bombing. I used to just forget the sight. Just bomb off the nose of the Thunderbolt. Kentucky wind, it's a little skid, and a little tad runner here. Plunk him in. Well, I miss now. Not too well. Then I went up to element lead, which is you leave one other airplane beside yourself, then flight lead, then squadron lead. Some guys never got there. They had God-given limitations. Some guys could not roll a Thunderbolt over and split S 10 to 12,000 feet. They just didn't have them here and so forth. Later on, I fired 6 guys out of an F-100 outfit, and 5 came back and said, thanks a lot, Colonel, that airplane about ready to kill me. If your eyes are bad, if you're 6'4" and you can't fit in the cockpit, or you just don't have the coordination, it's not your fault. I'll just digress, and I'll say this, shoot for a different mountain. not a lower mountain. I'm not saying if you're not a fighter pilot, you must shoot for a lower mountain. I'm saying shoot for a different mountain, something that'll fit in. Some guys were just kind of yelling. A lot of guys had bad attitudes. Boy, I ought to be the squadron commander. I ought to be the flight leader. They just didn't hack it. There'd be a lot of accidents. Some were funny, some were tragic. A good friend of mine, Test Top, I was watching him hit a church, tore a wing off. I picked him up in a rubber bag, which we did for most of the guys. I'll never forget his hand. Yeah? Just that hand I picked up, just picked it out of the rocks, and I saw that hand in my sleep for about 2 weeks. Had guys killed on takeoff, guys killed on landing. One incident with a hung bomb sometime, and it was just such an ancient system, you wouldn't believe it. We had to arm our bomb by pulling wire. You can't pull much this way. You know, this way you pull much. And this guy had hung bomb. We had a pattern. We came out on the deck, do a 360 and land, which kept us, you know, out of the ACAC if you were up about an airfield real close. This guy had been pitched, and the bomb came off, fell in the squadron area, killed about three guys. I had a hung bomb one time, leading a squadron. I came back, told them all to get on down because I'm low on petrol. I called up the group command. He says, do what you want. The box score was lousy. One guy landed on the strip a few days before, and the bomb went off. Another guy landed off the strip. He got killed. Another guy bailed out. He got hit by the tail. So the group command said, do what you want. I said, okay, clear the airbase. So I backed off. And I had all kinds of wire in the cockpit. And just before I landed, some cockroach in an airplane or a ground set, he punched me. He says, why don't you go somewhere else and die? And that didn't make me feel very good. But I landed and the bombs come off and they started to tumble. They didn't go off because I'm here, huh? But we had these hung bombs. All sorts of things happened. We had an ME-1 and I constituent down a strip one day. We're all lined up to go bomb, and some idiot decided he would start his airplane, taxi out. This guy's mobile now, about 400 knots. He would take off and drop his bombs and go kill ME-1 and I, which is ludicrous. But he fired up and he overpowered it, the thing went on fire, and all the rest of the guys jumped out. So all the airplane going on fire. So I fired up and I taxied off the aerodrome, down a highway to a town about 6 miles away. And these Frenchmen were saying, ah, qu'est-ce que c'est, I'm taking the bomb, le boom, boom. Bang goes the bomb, and they join me in a hole there. I'd like to give you some other wild and diverse missions. No order, just sort of examples. Had a chance to knock down the Leaning Tower of Pisa. There it was, you know, sitting there like that. And I had a bomb, and I'm saying, should I? And you know, Chandel off, and there's all the Germans, and they're shooting at me. I went back later on with my wife and some kids, and I think a 1,000-pound bomb would have dropped it. Really good. I'm Catholic, but I shot up the Pope's convoy one time. We allowed the Pope to go from Rome to the Po Valley to get more vino and see his priests and whatever up there. On the way back, I come nipping across the deck, and there's this whole line of trucks, and we passed him, and they blew to 2,000 or 3,000. That's pretty powerful vino. Then I see the papal color is the white cross and the yellow background. I said, I'm going to be excommunicated. But I wasn't. Flak trap. The Germans were pretty sneaky. They used to take these small ravines and stretch a nice wire across it, and maybe leave a big truck or something. He'd come buzzing down, zup, cut a wing off. I fell for one time. It was a train. I said, why is this train out here? Boy, this is the bee's knees. And I whipped all those thunderbolts around. And as they come down to final approach, the top came off, the sides fell down, and there's the crowds on their shores, just hammering away with every gun they could find. We didn't kill anybody, but boy, had some dumb missions. It's probably been in the history books that we did a little drinking. We did a little drinking. Not as much as you guys in Roscoe. I just went to Delta Tau Delta with my son, and God, it's just a big bar. But I remember one mission around, and the leader said, anybody see the target? Nothing. Does anybody know where we are? Nothing. He said, screw it, pickle them off, we'll go home. So we, 12 guys, dropped the bombs, went home. One time, couldn't find the target. And the leader says, there's a motorcycle. Four guys dive bombing, didn't hit them. The other four on the dive bomb. 12 guys, I can never forget the briefing. The intelligence says, what do you do? Well, we dive bomb motorcycle. 11 guys, what do you do? Dive bomb motorcycle. Why he said, did you hit him? No. I had a kid in my fight for the Army. He got a combat checkout from 340 to a Thunderbolt. Got one trip around the base. The guy said, "You're combat ready." Next day, he took off a load of bombs, got up there, and he got hit. Jack Butler in red form hit. "Who's this red form?" He said, "Who is it?" "It's Pernicka." He says, "Who?" He says, "Pernicka." He says, "Spell it." The guy's P-E-R, and I said, "Strut, man." It's wild. Remember, there's hard ones in between all these, huh? Had air raids. They used to drop these damn bombs, plus some butterfly bombs, little small, on about 4-pound bombs. Call them butterflies. They had little things. They'd land all over. Apple trees, God knows what. And they'd sit there until you touched them. And I used to watch. You could tell these Corsican girls, women, most of the men were gone. They'd, "Don't mess with that stuff." "Why, these are my trees, my grandfather's trees." They'd climb up and boom, they'd blow an arm off. Just, you know, bad scene. We used to make liquor runs. You talk about improvising. Second lieutenant, 19. "Venture's $1,000, go to Catania Sisters and get some booze." "Yes, sir." So we took the tanks, put up holes in them, not using no gas, flew down here, filled them up full of bottles, came back, landed on the strip. Jesus, before the prop stopped, they'd be in it. Gotta have some ice. Got a moose down the tanks, got some holes in it, put some water in it, and drove the guy to 30,000 feet and milled around him down. Cold water. Learned then we had a, what do you call it, put those little compartments in it. Then we got ice. We used to scrounge. Anybody ever heard about scrounging? The art of getting things you want without really asking permission. Better to ask forgiveness than permission. You know, I said things were tough, huh? There's lots of times, you know, we thought this. We really thought that why should our former enemies, especially like the Italians, and of course, why should they have cars and cows and radios? But we didn't have them. And we were eating dehydrated potatoes, little squares that they put in water for about 2 hours, and bully beef. Morning, noon, and night. So what we did, we went out and got some food. We take the flight surgeon, go out and find one cow tied to a porch, and he checked the teeth. Boom, we drop it. Put it in a 2.5-ton truck and bring it back. They didn't like that, but if you ever looked at the 45s, got a hole about that big. As soon as they opened their mouth, we just put it right next to their forehead, and they said, "Go ahead, take the cow." We used to have pointy talkies, a little tiny book that the government made for the various countries you're in. And had all these words down, so you could take your little book. I remember I went to Bastia looking for some eggs. I found out the chicken was Laglina and egg was Ova. So I'm up there with this woman, "Hey, Laglina, Ova." And she said, "Come here." I was going to trade off my sea rations. Went down in her cellar, she had 3 tons sea rations. I said, "Why the hell should she have all that kind of stuff? Why should she have chickens and eggs?" So I took my 45 out, and I took the eggs. I did what any other red-blooded father power would do. I took the chicken stool. "You want a staff car? I'm walking. Hey, I'm walking to the strip." This Italian's driving, so at night we're just nothing but crooks with rank. We go out hide in the woods. Here comes the guy down, his little Fiat, and howl, stop. I'm the Amo, Fati, Via. Go! Drive it back to the squadron, paint an OD, get some fictitious numbers, you had a staff car. Really wanted something, we'd take little signs. Achtung Minen. Germany's attention to mines. We plant it all around a boat or a car. We're good. Ultimate and penultimate was one day we found this beautiful bill. I've got pictures and rugs and radio. Took it off. A hell of a haul. Next day, some major said, "Would you mind returning General Mark Clark's furniture?" 4-star commander of the 5th Army, we had stolen a guy's blind. We even scrounged some nurses. I shouldn't say scrounged some nurses. We had no girls over there. So we could go to Naples to get a whole B-25 bomb load full of girls and bring back to the spin. I can still hear him screaming. "Where do you go? You got 75 drunken fighter pilots waiting on the strip to have a dance?" I better stop that. Now, we used to go to Rome for the R&Rs, and I used to be down in Egypt. Had a ball down in Egypt, had a ball in Rome. And you can imagine, you know, in Rome we were the liberators, huh? The Germans had just moved out of the north side of town. We came in the south side, very smartly started an R&R hotel. And the girls, I dropped that one too, I think. Okay, my mission built up and finally went through just lots of stuff. And on the 75th mission, I shot down my first ME-109, first and only one. And that, you know, that started it. My dream was on the way. I got my first airplane. And I fired so far out of range that the three of them turned right around and all started firing me again. That's how shaky I was. But I finally dropped the one guy, and I think we got about 10 out of the whole show. I bombed and strafed my way up to about 106 missions. I extended to 125 because I want to get four more Mi-109, but they sent me home at 106. After World War II, I kind of changed my dream. I just loved the fighter game so much, I used to put them all on my wish list and all my papers. I want to make ace, I want to make colonel, and I want to stay in fighters all my life. And that was my dream. That's what I kept putting down. They got sick of me, and they always put me where I want. They got so sick of me. They said, where are you going to go? And they always sent me there. After World War II, went to Waldenboro, South Carolina, flying P-40s again after combat. It was a P-40N. It was designed to fight the Zero. They took the back fuselage tank out and put a little tiny cockpit with about two instruments and a stick, and that's where they put me. And it wasn't the best in the world, but it was something. About that time, we recognized the need for dissimilar combat training. By that, I mean, P-40 against a P-40 is one, you don't learn much. P-40 against a Hellcat or a Wildcat or a Pussycat or something, you learn a bunch. It's like driving two Porsches in a race. You know what they're going to do, you know what your buddy's going to do, but you put a Porsche against a Corvette, and you're starting to learn something. Today, we're finally getting to, I think it's called Red Flag out there. We've got the same stuff over in Europe and the Far East. They're finally learning. We used to fly high and safe for so many years, and it cost us. It cost us when we had to go to combat. We didn't know how to fly in a deck, didn't know how to fight dissimilar aircraft. Back to Selfridge Field, P-47s. It was the end of the war. It's what we call the lean years. It was so bad, I had to be my own crew chief. I was changing things I couldn't pronounce, carburetors and all that stuff. And one day it got so bad I refused to fly it. The colonel said, "Well, court martial, that's a good deal. You do that. I ain't going to fly it." I'll fly it. Took off and the engine quit. I take off. By the grace of God, he made it back to his ship. He never said another word. We had no uniforms. The old man said, "Fly anything you want." I gave him a Coca-Cola outfit. Put on this tremendous air show, oil loops off the deck and landed. Some sergeant grabbed me and said, "Get the hell off the flight line." Right to the AP shack I went. I finally had to get the ID card out and say, "Hey, I'm one of those pilots." And they said, "We can't put up with this study. We know now what's the person who couldn't." I learned in those days, in about 46, 47, something like that, never mess with the troops. Never mess with the troops. And why I say that, we had this pompous colonel. We used to walk in the first equipment with his parachute for 90 days, and he'd go, "Pow!" He'd say, "Faggot." That went on three times. The fourth time he did that, he said, "Packet." Four GI blankets fell out. He turned blue, green, indigo. Never said a word. No court martials. But you don't mess with the troops. Don't put them on. It just doesn't work. On to the occupation of Germany. I went back into Thunderbolts and P-51s. Good tour duty. We owned everything. We owned the airfield, the transportation, the hotels, the women, the recreation centers, the women, the booze. It was great. Again, go to certain locations in this room. I will drop that conversation. We did have some good flying. We were the conquerors. We could do what we wanted. We could fly. We could fly as low as we wanted. Do any damn thing we wanted to do. I had some unique flying that probably not too many people did. Better to ask forgiveness and permission. We used to do night aerobatics in P-51s. We had a beautiful moon out there, and the Alps sitting there is a big, white, jagged line, and we'd go up there and rat race and just do rolls and loops and all that by the hour. And I don't think the astronauts got that kind of stuff. And that stuff you can't buy. Back to the States, P-51s again, then jets. P-80. Somebody drove a P-80 in and said, "That's a jet." Oh, yeah. So, no prop. Oh, big deal. We got about 2 hours, this kind of stuff. Got out of the cockpit. "See that? See that set? Good luck, sir." Boy, I'm up there flying. No props, man. Big deal. I had to do that. I got 1 hour because the next day I was off to fly an F-84. Whatever the hell that was. So they sent him to New York, and we picked him up at the factory. We call it straight wing crowbar. We had a hell of a job ferrying those things from New York down to Roswell. We had some tough flights. We still weren't too smart. We didn't know much about IFR. IFR was I Follow Railroads. We didn't know much about navigation. Very little. One flight I can remember, I lost four out of five. And I was number five, the B. was beyond my control. I took off out of Otis one time, and I told these two guys to follow me, and they didn't. They went a different route, and they both bailed out in thunderstorms. I got to Wright Pat, the guy's engine blew up on takeoff. There was two of us, got to Hill Field, the guy over-rotated, was sailing off the goddamn runway. That left me. I got up here going to Moses Field, I lost everything. Instruments, electrical. I got into this big white tomb, it all clouded over, and I let down, and I came out between two mountains. So I did a whole job. Four airplanes didn't make it, and I almost bit it myself. Roswell was hot. We started to fly at 4 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock. We had improvised. We couldn't fly in daytime. It just wouldn't get off the ground. It would suck up 12,000 feet. And the only time it would fly is when the nose wheel got in the overrun. And we figured that the nose wheel must tell the airplane, hey, stupid, you're in the overrun and you're going to crash. You're leaving in the air. So then we got smart. We built a sand sniffer. It was a box of sand. We had a little switch in the cockpit. Halfway down the runway, we'd hit the switch. The sand would come out on the nose wheel. The nose wheel would tell the airplane, hey, stupid, you're in a overrun. And we were jumping here. Anybody believe that? I found one guy that did. Jesus. On to Otis F-86s. Good airplane. The first swept wing type first one you can get supersonic by diving the hell out of it. We expanded and developed our air-to-air tactics, flight squadron level. As tactics improved, we found that we needed the older head. We just couldn't have the EDC of 5 extra, you know, runs on a damn $2,000 truck and so forth. And education started to become important. I had to fight like hell to stay in fighters as far as a fighter day pilot. We got F-94s and everybody converted to all weather. They didn't need all weather in Korea, they wanted fighter day pilots. So I had to fight like hell to maintain my fighter day rating. I finally volunteered 19 times, they finally shipped me out. I got to Japan, they said, good deal, F-84 squadron commander. I said, no, I want to fly against the bigs in the 4th fighter wing, thank you very much. They said, no, 84 squadron commander. I got on the horn, I engineered, I finally got to 51st. It was one of the two F-86 outs. I got to wherever the hell it was. Sooner or later, I saw a jeep come down the road. I said, sorry, take me to Seoul. The drone going down, the flight line started an engine. I said, no, take me to Seoul, 100 miles north, right now. He'd still be fun. He'd still be 100 miles north, drop me in the 4th fighter wing. And that's a hell of a way to get to combat. That much fight to get in combat, but I finally got where I wanted. And it looked a little bit, you know, a bit shaky. We only had 2 wings of 86s, 75 airplanes each, normally mounted about 48 kites, and they had hundreds and hundreds of MiGs. 51s, 80s, 84s couldn't hack the MiG. I consider this really one of the last sport. Yes? Major. Yeah. I consider this one of the last sport model wars. You know, it's air to air, no outside influence, no ECM, no missiles, no air to air missiles, no air to ground missiles. VFR, your butt against mine, great way to fight. I got a quick orientation flight, bomb line checkout, zoom. Just in case, I found one guy who didn't know how to make ace. How to make ace, you gotta shoot down 5 airplanes in the air, and the rules went like this. The pilot had to bail out, had to lose a major part of the aircraft, like the wing come off, or persistent fire, a couple seconds of long sheet of flame. All had to be confirmed on film by wingman. Now, as to luck, I believe in luck, but I really believe that luck is where education and opportunity come together. Education and opportunity. I got my first damaged flying with Robbie Reisner. Many of you heard of Robbie Reisner. We had a deal called Hot Pursuit. Sometimes it was on, sometimes it was off. It was a dumb thing in my opinion. They used to run across the border, just kind of wave their whatever at us. And I dove across Antung just smoking 1.02 Mach or somewhere, which is pretty hot for the 86. And Robbie was saying, let's go home, let's go home. I could care less about the Yellow River about that time. I was going to get my first victory. And on the way back, you know, Robbie was just as nervous as a pregnant nun, you know, what we were worried about. You can see that in the film. So just like you see, I kind of the camera, I got back, and I went to the front of the airplane, opened up, took the film out, and I went like this. And the guy, what the hell are you doing, Major? I said, Jim, I got it. And they got a film, so I can get exposed completely, you know. I didn't dare let him see Antung go by. First kill was a piece of cake. They going this way, I was coming this way. I got right behind him, looking around, know what I mean? Put my speed brakes off, get right up on his butt. It was tail pipe and bail out. This is nice. This is it. It really was bad because I used to snap shoot after that. Why does he die? Pete Fernandez, who just got killed in this very lousy circumstances, used to tell me, Steve, remember, electrical tapes were on the site in a long burst. And the idea is once you get a big in front of you, shoot until the gun barrels go boom. I learned that the hard way. Second kill, got a long distance. I was telling somebody today, you get up there on a Yalu River with a small bag of gas, and you see a contrail here and a contrail on that one. Who's a MiG and who's an 86? You chase the wrong one, there goes the show. You don't see it that many times. I don't care how good a fisherman, there ain't no fish, you ain't gonna get anything. So I developed the idea, I'll take a binoculars, and I'll be able to look at it. But right here in the transition, if you ever take your eyes off an enemy air, or any airplane, especially in those days, because they had them painted, and the bottom was painted sort of baby blue, and the top was a model green and brown. If you took your eyes off them, for 1 second, check the thing, it's all over. So we used to call it padlocks, which means I had my eyeballs on an airplane and everybody fly off me. So I tried the binoculars and lost them. So I cut this GI binocular right in half and I got a binocular. And after that, when I called padlock, I just, you know, I had my Mark One eyeball on them, bring the binocular up, and I had them. All I had to see if this high tail plane and the Texaco sign on the side, a big star. That's all I needed. And I got two MiGs doing that. And they were wondering how I did it. I told them. Now I'm going to tell you a secret. I told my wife last night. First time. I had a friend of mine in intelligence at Fifth Air Force. And he knew when the Koreans and the Chinese would graduate. And for their graduation day, the cadets would come steaming across the Yalu, about another 100 miles under the Chon Chon River, do a turnabout, roaring home. And that's the days we got 10, 15 MiGs. So, by pre-arrangement, call up, say, Steve, boys, graduation day. So I say, hey, Robbie Wright, I'm on a sweep, man. I beat him out of a few. And there was MiGs all over the place. Fourth MiG, I was over the Mizu, which is the reservoir, and I had the worst fight I had in my life. I fought about 12 MiGs for about 18 minutes, and they were Russians, too. They were black MiGs. The Russians were good. The Chinese are fair. Koreans are idiots. I say Russian because one time one of the flight of MiGs got shot down near the island Chodo. His own flight came around and strafed him in the water. So we couldn't see which way his eyes went. You know? And we also knew from other intelligence sources. As an aside, to show you how cool you get in combat, remember this guy calling in? I had about that much fuel. This guy called in. Flame out, and the tower said, Roger, number three. He says, you idiot, I said I'm flamed out. I said, you're the third one flamed out. Two more joined him, and one cool cat named Vermont Garrison, who Bob used to work for, said, hey, everybody just land on the right. We had a single strip. Guys with altitude came down to the south and turned around and landed to the north on the right side. Guys with very little altitude came in and landed straight south. And five airplanes passing on the runway just got an engine going. Years later, they would close a 12,000-foot strip on me because one guy was off to the side with a blown tire and divert me all over Europe. Here we had a little 5,400-foot strip or something. I think five airplanes wiped out. Maybe a little more. Okay. I used to push to get on these fighter sweeps. I should have said earlier on that we had fighter-bomber escort, we had recce escort, we had weather checks, but the sweeps down the Yalu were the ones that got the MiGs. I took off. You know, some things you shouldn't do. You know, you don't play leapfrog with a unicorn. I took off, and the only thing that worked was the motor. No radio, no nothing. I had about that much of battery, I figured I'd turn the gun switch on, because I knew I had four MiGs. I wanted to get the last MiG. So I played like it was going to be on no radio time. Wind up, you know, let's go. God, would you believe there's a million MiGs up there? And as I pulled up, I frosted over again. And I'm in that little god darn white tomb. I take my gloves off and I scratch. God, here's a MiG 15 going boom, boom, boom. And I break into where? I don't know where the horizon is, the world, the ground. And I'm scratching the ice off. And I finally said, screw it. And I went home. By the grace of God, nobody touched me. There must have been 50 MiGs in the air. Fantastic. 96 mission. The colonel said I had 95 and a half. That's true. Because the other part I sort of walked home. Sweeping Ayalo. Start out bad. Sent the wingman home. He got killed. Got to the mouth of the Yalu. There was a flight that lost the leader, and the kids were kind of panicky, and I got them squared off, and I sent them back. That's just the wingman and I. We dove in about 25 minutes. We had them all. And I finally nailed this baby. Boy, I was the 39th in the death time, in fact, the last jet ace in the world. Just feeling great. I got down low, got hit by a little flak. She started, and my wingman, Tom McQuaid, had about 10 MiGs on his butt. I should have been heading out for the ocean. I started out, and instead of getting out there where I would have been rescued, I looked at Tom, and he was in deep, serious kimchi. He was bad trouble. So I told him to pull in front of me, and I'd hose off the MiGs, which I did. I thought that was pretty nice. This one. I mean, my life, I had both feet on the dashboard, and as the goddamn MiGs went by, I just clamped down. I don't know what I got it. I could care less, because I knew I was going to bail out in a matter of seconds. As it turned out, I made a grave mistake. I took my mat, which was on a cardboard, instead of putting it on the left side, which was that panel, just sort of locked the seat harness, I put it on the right side. I finally started to bail out. The MiG came up and finished me off. Just blew the ass out. I had the thing on the right-hand side, and because of the negative Gs, I couldn't get a hold of the handle. It kept hitting the mat. So with the feet up against the dashboard, I just reached underneath and scooped. And I went out sort of like a big U, which is not the way to bail out of a jet. I was mobile. I figured somewhere 400 knots or so. I got out about 1,500 feet. Boom, went to shoot. Four panels went. And I went to all my training. I said, I know what I'll do. I will slip the chute out to the ocean. And I slipped it, and it collapsed. I shook it out about three times, and my feet hit the ground. I'd made the quickest inventory of arms and legs and eyeballs. Things that I got hit here and here, and my legs are kind of battered, but I made it. Then things really started to go to hell. Some guy came down to take a look at me. He pranked about from here to the back of the room. The water, if you know anything about water flying, they had a stone jetty coming up from out of the Yalu and made the water very quiet. To fly over water when it's very, very calm is tough. You don't know where you are, 500 feet. He came down, just went and wiped out a bunch of fishermen that were fishing around. That didn't bother me. I was in a little sandpan when he picked me up. I jumped out of the sandpan. Some guy took a squirt at me with his gun, missed me. And they picked me up, and things went to hell in a handbasket. I went through the whole deal. I went to the first little short prison camp. My legs got so big they had to choke me around. They gave me a little Japanese fella. I'm about the same weight, about 180. And boy, about 100 meters, he dropped. They gave me another Chinese. Finally got to prison camp, and the guy just unnerved me. He said, "Hello, Steve." I went through the whole bit with him. Almost senior officer, and I expect to be treated in the Articles of War. The guy said, "Shut up, sit down, we're going to shoot you." And I just raised out, didn't work at all. I knew the guys. When I got out of solitary confinement, I knew many of the guys there, and I said, "Gee, I'm glad they didn't ask me about this top secret." The guy said, "Shut up." I knew half the guys. I trained them, they're my squadron. And he says, later on in the compound, when they're whistling to fool the bugs and all that kind of stuff, he says, "Hey, somebody squeal. Anything you say to the Chinese will have in 30 minutes. They'll just jerk you out and make you do all kinds of things." And that was hard to take. I could write a book on the whole business as far as prison care. But we got out on Operation Big Switch. One thing stuck in my mind. You know, it's probably one of the most poignant moments of my life. I see disrespect to the flag today. I see kids riding motorbikes with the flag on their butt, and this, and people sitting drinking beer at these games, and I just get livid. I was coming down to Freedom Village in a Russian truck, about 20 POWs. Came around a corner, and there was a flagpole. Some GI gave us a highball, and on top of that was Old Glory. And this guy said, "My God, boys," he says, "there's our flag." And 20 guys broke out crying. You go through something like that, and you watch these people sitting there drinking their beer when they're playing the anthem. I just like to probably go throttle. Okay, after the war, it's a bit anticlimactic. I made ace. Now I'll tell you how stupid I was. Everybody told you I shot down the B-109? After I had four MiGs, plus One of you went online. I was an ace and didn't know it. Nobody told me.
I didn't know it.
But I went out and busted my banana to get the fifth one. And I already made ace and didn't know it. Kind of dumb. Back to George Air Force Base. Got an F-100 squadron. More responsibility. Squadron commander, all this business. One of the world's first supersonic outfits. It's a good flying. We had a new training onto that. Became Jack Armstrong, all-American boy, dive bomb, strafe, deliver weapons, nuclear weapons, so forth. Off to Europe, went to Tain, France, got an F-100 squadron over there. You know, and after George, where you clear in 4 days visibility, I got this Tain, France, they gave me the squadron, I walked down the flight line, I said, where the hell's the airplane? Weather broke, sir. 200 and a half, raining like hell. I said, okay, no more jokes, where's the airplane? They're flying. So we've had fog, sir, for 2 weeks. Now the weather broke, 200 and a half. I'd come from Georgia, I hadn't flown a GCA in 3 years, but I did it over there. We had some tough weather flying. We still didn't have the nav equipment. I can remember the time I took off at night, we said, attention aircraft, the GCA fell off the chocks with the wind. And then 20 minutes later, attention all aircraft, all airfields in Europe are closed. Divert to Aviano, Italy. How much gas you got? 800 pounds, sir. How about you? You, get a flashlight, big, big, big. No receiver, no transmitter. So you shine your light. How much fuel you got? 500 pounds. Aviano, Italy? Across the Alps? Across Switzerland? 500 pounds? Not enough for one good letdown. So you call up GCA and say, please keep talking. Okay, we're going to go right down to the deck. So you got guys in your wing and no radio. You have one pass. Normally they'd cut you off. Well, you're a GCA, but it was good night, sir. Say, oh, that's good night, sir. Jazz. You keep on pressing, also. Lights go by. That's the runway. Suck it back. Prang in. Bullshit. Hope you get a shoot too. I never lost a pilot. Never lost an airplane. Got 2 USAF Flying Safety Awards, which I thought was good. They tapped me for the IG in the USAFE over there. I became the ORI team chief, and that was I had to inspect every unit in Africa and Europe and England and Turkey and Greece to determine if they're combat ready. My report went right back to the Pentagon, chief of staff. Everybody saw it. I guess the president on down. Hell of a responsibility. After Europe, about to attack, worked on an A-10. Somebody asked me about the A-10 today. Lovely airplane. Worked on F-111, TFX. Terrible, frightening experience, we call it. Spent 4 years on that from the time I flew it. Worked on the F-15, worked on a lot of other subsystems, guns, engines, God knows what. Lastly, I was assigned to NATO, half cent, Allied Forces of Central Europe. I was responsible for all the NATO, Central Europe, live competitions and some exercises I had. Tactic weapons meet, air defense competitions, air defense exercises, recce competitions. I even had a tank competition, a rifle competition, which I didn't think about. And I gave it to a Belgian major. I ain't never seen him since. I worked with 7 nations. I really had a purple suit. You know, they gave me a lot of responsibility. It was a fulfilling career. I effectively, for instance, at great personal expense, effectively used Navy carriers in my exercises. When I did that, I would get 2, 3, and 4-star Air Force generals saying, now, Colonel, we don't want to use that Navy too well, do we? And I used to say, hey, you don't like it, get yourself another colonel. You know, I effectively used them up in the North Sea in the Bay of Biscay, and it worked, because we might have gone to war the next day. And actually, they were thinking, hey, they're going to buy airplanes or carriers. Let's not let them, make them look too good. But that tour was over. And that's the point I'd like to make here, as you can see, I went from a wingman to P-40 straight to an ORI team chief type thing. Responsibility was there. I finally said, okay, retirement. I had 31 years. I went to McCord. I didn't want to retire from the blockhouse. I went to the cadets, the cadet academy, and gave my last swan song to 2,500 cadets, which was grand for me. I retired in January 73. So my career was over. You know, I had done everything I wanted to do. More importantly, I did everything the Air Force wanted me. Close to the end. Hey, that was it. Retirement, I'd done my job. Now, tonight, I didn't intend to be a recruiting speech. I just thought I'd give you an insight into the roots. I hope you join, if you want it. Not if your mother wants it, your father, your girlfriend, your wife. If you want it, if you want to be an officer, go for it. I hope you have a career just as full as I have. It's a hell of a good deal. Good luck. Thank you.